KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Earlier today, North Korea's foreign minister ratcheted up the war of words with the United States, saying that President Trump's recent remarks amounted to a declaration of war. He also said that his country had the right to shoot down American warplanes, even if they are not in North Korean airspace. President Trump has called North Korea's leader a rocket man on a suicide mission and warned on Saturday that the country won't be around much longer. Also today, China said that it hoped all sides would exercise restraint over North Korea. In this hour, we talk about the latest contentious exchange and what it portends for U.S.-North Korea relations. Joining us here in studio is Philip Yoon. He's Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Plowshares Fund, former Vice President at the Asia Foundation, Senior Policy Advisor to the U.S. State Department. And welcome back to Forum, Philip Yoon.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Jeffrey Lewis is also with us. He's Director of the East Asia Nonproliferation Program with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He's also founding publisher of the blog ArmsControlWonk.com and joins us by phone. Jeffrey Lewis, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me begin, Philip Yoon, with you. This latest, talking about Trump's declaration of war. Well, technically, the United States and North Korea are still at war from the 1950s. I don't want to necessarily make too much of that, but it is indeed a fact. But talking about shooting down American planes and all, I mean, the rhetoric just keeps getting ratcheted up more and more, and you have to wonder, one miscalculation or one unintended consequence of all this rhetoric is going to take us into a possible very serious kind of apocalyptic Armageddon of sorts.
I think that's a very real possibility. It's still relatively small, but I think that's something we need to be concerned about. We've always said that we're not really worried about a unilateral attack by North Korea on the United States. What we are worried about is miscalculation. And what we have here is a rising sort of escalatory set of rhetoric, which puts both sides in a box where they actually have to act. And this most recent particular exchange is very troubling because in many ways it's extremely personal. And it's unprecedented in that Kim Jong-un has felt in a video to respond directly. So he has this forum, a one-on-one conversation with the president of the United States, which
Forgive
in many
me,
ways.
But you got two billionaires who have lived in cocoons their whole life and continue to be in cocoons shouting things at each other.
Exactly. And, yeah, it's a shouting match and a game of chicken, which is very dangerous when both countries have nuclear weapons.
And you have the sense, Jeffrey Lewis, that these nuclear weapons are at the ready on both sides. You know, when President Trump talks about fire and Kim Jong-un talks about fire and the latest threat has been about a hydrogen bomb explosion in the Pacific. What are we to make of that?
Well, you know, it really shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. I mean, the North Koreans have been steadily developing these nuclear capabilities because they are afraid of being attacked, and they're trying to express the idea that they have the ability to retaliate. And in the United States, we've been very reluctant to accept this reality, sort of saying, well, maybe they have a bomb, maybe they have a missile, but we don't really know that they can put the two of them together. The United States actually did something very similar to China in the 1960s when it was developing its first nuclear weapons. The Johnson administration said, well, you have a bomb, you have a missile, but you don't really have a nuclear weapon system. So what the Chinese did was they put a live nuclear weapon on a live missile and fired it across their country. You know, I think the North Koreans are facing a very similar dilemma, which is they're trying to reinforce that they really have this capability, and we keep daring them to prove it.
Well, you mentioned China, and Philip Yoon, the Chinese Central Bank which is essentially the Bank of China, has taken a strong position. Sanctions are in order here. China's behind them. And the all notion was somehow if China got on board in a major way, it would move the needle somehow. But it doesn't seem to be moving, and it doesn't seem to matter to North Korea.
Yeah, exactly. I think that everything with respect to China is implementation. And to this point, China's implementation has been very spotty. There was an executive order issued by President Trump, which I think also prompted some of this escalatory rhetoric that's going on, that's shutting down financial transactions, which are really big. These are third parties. So essentially, the United States, instead of directing it at North Koreans or Americans, it's third countries. Predominantly will be Chinese financial institutions as well. And so China is on board with this. But again, we have been doing this for a very, very long time. And when it comes down to financial sanctions and really what North Korea seems is its deterrence that it needs to protect itself, there's no choice as far as the North Koreans are concerned. They're going to go with continuing to develop these nuclear weapons, and that's where we are right now.
And Jeffrey Lewis, there was an earthquake Saturday near the nuclear test site, apparently a real earthquake. At first, there was a lot of speculating about the fact that it might have been another explosion set off by the North Koreans, nuclear or otherwise. But the fact of the matter is that our Air Force has sent planes flying over international airspace just east of North Korea on Saturday, the farthest that they've ever been on the DMZ. And this, again, certainly bodes very seriously.
Well, right. I think what you're seeing is precisely the lead up to the concern that Philip raised, which is that you run this risk of miscalculation. You know, it's easy to imagine that these are just words, that this is just Trump insulting Kim and Kim responding. The problem is that these words are being backed up by military signaling, and it's the easiest thing in the world to imagine that one of these signals might go too far. And so now we're faced with the prospect that we're flying bombers over the peninsula, and the North Koreans are talking about shooting them down. And I think the North Koreans are deadly serious about that.
And what about the role, Philip, you know, I can bring you back into this from just the Asian perspective of, I mean, actually South Korea and Japan are talking now and seem to be allied. That's one good thing that's come out of this, because there was a good deal of tension. But President Trump has criticized South Korea for appeasement, and the fact of the matter is that South Korea and Japan seem to be right in kind of the headbeams of Kim Jong-un, along with the United States.
Well, this is all unsettling for the Japanese and the North Koreans, not only because of what's going on in what North Korea is doing. They've lived under the threat of, incredible military attack by North Korea. But Donald Trump is adding to this. There's this whole thing about uncertainty about the reliability of the United States. So one thing on the deterrent side, it's sort of the notion that if North Korea has a nuclear weapon that is able to hit the United States, will the United States come to the aid of Tokyo and Seoul if they are attacked? And our country, our cities are at risk. That's on one side. On the other side, what we've talked about is that they don't want to have a unilateral attack or by the United States, and there's been talk of that. So they're wondering, does the United States really, and the South Koreans and Japanese saying, if there is a unilateral attack and there's a war, those countries are going to bear the brunt of it. And are you, the United States, these are the South Koreans and Japanese side, do you really care about our interests? Because at this point, a unilateral strike is not in our interest, and yet you're still talking about it.
And Jeffrey Lewis, it's one thing to talk about the President of the United States as being mentally deranged and a dotard, and for that matter, the President calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and saying, rather derogatory things about him. But the President of the United States also, at the United Nations speech, said, we will totally destroy the country of 26 million. I mean, that kind of rhetoric almost exceeds the boundaries of what one thinks about as normal discourse coming from the United States. The United States has always been certainly not using that kind of rhetoric prior to Trump at all.
Well, yeah, I don't think it almost exceeds. I mean, I think it does exceed. And I think we're at risk of normalizing some of that rhetoric by not being clear that it's really wildly inappropriate. You know, I wrote a column where I compared Trump's appearance rather unfavorably to Khrushchev banging his shoe or Arafat wearing a gun. I mean, it really was an unsettling performance. The problem that I think this runs is, again, it's not just that it's bellicose rhetoric. North Koreans, by the way, pointed out something very interesting in Kim Jong-un's statement, which was that they basically said that it was fine if Trump were making these remarks extemporaneously, but the fact that they were part of a prepared speech was something that they found very upsetting, because it suggests that this isn't just the prerogative of a demagogue, but actually the considered opinion of the U.S. government. And so, you know, you really run this risk that these words find their way into policies. So, you know, the president has said these things, and so he feels obligated to follow through on them, right? So, you know, you have these bomber overflights. The North Koreans then feel obligated to do something about the bomber overflights, and so now they're talking about shooting them down. So, again, you know, the rhetoric piece will slowly but surely get implemented into the policies of both countries and express itself in military actions. And I think, as Philip said at the beginning, there's every chance, it's a small chance, but it's a real chance, that you could have a serious miscalculation leading to a war.
Well, let me bring our listeners into this. I know many of you have strong emotions in the light of particularly what's been going on and what continues to go on today. As I said, North Korea calling President Trump's comments a declaration of war when he said that North Korean leadership may not be around much longer. And the fact of the matter is that they said they have the right to shoot down American warplanes. Let's hear from you. Let me open the phone lines. Our toll-free number is available, and you can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number for you to call is 866-733-6786. We do appreciate hearing from you and want to hear your thoughts, so please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or express yourself by going right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Any questions or comments you might have, onto our website, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We're talking with Philip Young, Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of the Plowshares Fund, former Vice President of the Asia Foundation, and a Senior Policy Advisor at the U.S. State Department. And Jeffrey Lewis is with us by phone as Director of the East Asia Nonproliferation Program and a scholar with the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, the host of the Arms Control Wonk podcast. And again, I want to hear from you, our listeners. One of the most ironic things that has come to me in the wake of all of this is President Trump, as we know, is always talking about crowds that he's able to generate, whether it's being at Hurricane Harvey and the number of people that show up for that, or at his inauguration and so forth. The fact of the matter is that hundreds of thousands of people turned out in Pyongyang to support Kim Jong-un. This is a man who is a tyrant in terms of the way he treats his citizens, and the kind of torture that's gone on has all been well documented by human rights organizations and so forth. But he draws bigger crowds than Trump. Here's a listener who tweets, living on the West Coast, I'm worried a bomb might strike us. However, the inhumane treatment of North Korean citizens is unacceptable. End the regime. Philip Young, sentiments a lot of people have. You know, maybe somebody out of an old Hollywood movie type cast will circle his or her way into North Korea and get a shot at Kim Jong-un, or there will be some revolt. But there's too much repression there to even think of any kind of. And this is a man who's worshipped as God. This is a man who's believed to be omnipotent.
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely. It's wishful thinking. For right now, all indications are Kim Jong-un is firmly in control. The secret security apparatus is very secure. And very interestingly, anecdotally, again, this is anecdotally, when you talk with some defectors, one of the things that I got out of conversation was that they were saying that Kim Jong-un, they've been brainwashed, or that's the way they think. She wasn't part of a strong, you know, elite family. She was sort of a commoner. And she said, we all believe Kim Jong-un is a good guy. He's the father. If to the extent the policies are really bad, it's because the people around him are incompetent and corrupt. And so these are the things that they're pushing. I think that the human rights thing is absolutely.
But they're also blaming the United States.
They're blaming the United States, absolutely. Yeah. North Korea is in a state of war, and the United States is the reason for that in North Korea. And so, therefore, the human rights situation is absolutely appalling. I'd be the first one to say it would be great if the government did not exist. The problem is that we've got to figure out a way to essentially coexist with North Korea, because they aren't going away. And then the hope is that we're going to be able to figure out some kind of way to deal with the human rights situation, because at this point we have no influence, no push whatsoever. And that's the way I'm looking at it right now. But it's something that has to be dealt with. And I know that there will be an accounting for all the horrible and horrific things that are happening and have happened in North Korea. And that's something, as a member of humanity and the human race, we've got to be ready to deal with.
It's been documented, well documented. And when the President of the United States says they have to completely denuclearize, I think he's, you wonder what he's smoking. I mean, you know, they're going to keep these weapons. And I don't know how, even if there can be some diplomatic breakthroughs, you can get them to denuclearize, to give up the weapons that they have, which they feel are protecting them from their enemies. And there's a real kind of basic question that are on the mind of many listeners here in the Golden State, Jeffrey Lewis. Heidi tweets, can their missiles reach California? That's my main concern. New York Times wrote an in-depth piece on this, and their verdict was they aren't sure.
Yeah, those stories are garbage, to be completely honest. You know, what we're seeing is a widespread denial setting in. And that's, in fact, precisely why the North Koreans are talking about doing a thermonuclear test off of a missile. Yes, those missiles can reach targets throughout the United States. It's very clear when you look at the performance of the missile in all of the tests that it had enough energy that if it had been fired on a normal trajectory, it would have reached the U.S. I think what you're seeing now is this kind of desperate fantasy setting in, that this reality is not happening, that our policy isn't really failing. And so we imagine, I mean, the first story in the spring was, well, we're hacking the missiles until they'll blow up. Well, they didn't blow up. And so now there are, you know, endless stories. I think it's really time for Americans to accept that, you know, after a series of failed policies, administration after administration, refusing to deal with this problem diplomatically, that the North Koreans have done what the Soviets did, what the Chinese did, and they've gone ahead and they've built nuclear weapons that can arm missiles that can reach the United States.
All right, let me bring our callers on, and we go first to Oakland and Aaron. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hey, Michael, great show. I love it. I love your show. Listen, technically you're wrong because the Korean War was never actually a declared war. Okay, we're still in a state of aggression. That's true, but it was a UN police action. There was no declaration of war by the United States. I just want to make that point.
I believe that point is correct, but Jeffrey Lewis, we are technically still at war with North Korea, aren't we?
Well, we have an armistice and not a peace treaty. And so I think, you know, certainly the North Koreans feel like they were at war, and I think colloquially we do use the term war. Congress does, in fact, rarely declare war these days. The important thing to take away is the deeper point, which is that we don't have a settlement to the hostilities that broke out in the 1950s. We have an armistice, which is basically a ceasefire. And the North Koreans have been very clear that they want what they would call a peace treaty. And I think especially now that it seems like getting rid of the nuclear weapons is not a feasible diplomatic goal, one of the things we do have to talk about is reducing tensions. And I think finally getting to a point where we can move past the armistice and to a treaty that really begins to settle some of the fundamental issues that still linger, you know, 60 years on.
Philip, you want to add something?
Yeah, the North Koreans all the time, the time that I've had negotiate was involved in negotiations with them in the 1990s, talked about trying to end the hostile policy and the hostile position of the United States. And they've always looked at some kind of piece of paper to end the Korean, you know, these conflicts is very, very important. And it has been something that, for a variety of reasons, we have not been able to move forward with. And so that is one thing that has to happen when we eventually get around to the notion that we have to coexist with North Korea, however repugnant it is, and to deal with that in that fashion. And so it is the end of a hostile policy. It's the end of the state of war and recognition of that government's right to exist. And that's a policy issue.
Philip, you were an advisor of the State Department, and Noel raises a question, and I'd like to hear your response. She says, what is Rex Tillerson doing? I'm hoping he's working behind the scenes to solve the current crisis.
Well, Rex Tillerson's got a really, really hard job. And so my understanding is that he's working on the quiet side. There are people at the State Department who know North Korea, who are very good, who are trying to figure out a way to continue the conversation and to figure out a solution here. The problem is that this rhetoric that has been skyrocketing upwards in a game of chicken has made Tillerson's job so much more difficult. And because both sides are sort of backing themselves into a corner, it's going to be really hard for them on their own. And one of the things I want to point out, which is something I think on the positive side after Foreign Minister Ri's speech today, is at the same time, the North Koreans announced that a person who I know, Madam Che, who is the director of the U.S. desk in North Korea, is going to Moscow and presumably to have a conversation about how to de-escalate these tensions. So I don't think that announcement coming on the heels of the foreign minister, North Korean foreign minister's announcement, is a coincidence. And so here's the prospect of the Russians coming in as a third party to help to diffuse this tension right here. And if it was the Chinese, that's one thing. The Russians, given where we are with Putin, it's going to be very interesting to see how this
Putin
plays
would
out.
Probably love to have that gravitas, you know, of,
exactly.
Stepping in here. But, you know, it's not only Kim Jong-un with the rhetoric. The head of the Red Guard talked about final battle with the evil empire. You know, it harkens back to Iran and Khomeini and all that, but it's worse. Here's Luke. Luke, you're on.
Hi there. I just had a question. Thanks for taking my call, and I had a question for the guests there. You know, it seems to me, you know, there's a lot of talk about the United States needing to reach a deal with North Korea, and it seems to me, from having visited over there and spoken to South Koreans, a lot of people don't like the United States there. You know, and that's what a lot of people forget. It's like people talk now like, oh, we're going to war. Well, we're already there. And to me, it seems like the long-term solution is for us to broker a deal between North and South Korea and for the United States to leave and say Korea is going to be Korea and they can sort it out however they want. They can be two independent states like Oklahoma and Texas or whatever, but let's get out of the way and let there be a peaceful deal between the two countries that we split up in the first.
You know, Luke, that's an interesting notion. I mean, in light of all this America First stuff that's coming out of the Trump White House and, you know, let's not pay for other people's battles and conflicts and everything. Jeffrey Lewis seems unlikely, but what about what he's proposing here?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that South Korea, like the United States, is a very divided country. So, you know, we see a very wide range of opinions running from the right to the left in South Korea. And so, for example, the shift from the Park administration, she was the previous president who was impeached, to the Moon administration, the current president, is a shift from a very conservative president to a very progressive one. So it's not quite as simple as saying South Koreans want this or that. I certainly think that there are many progressive South Koreans who are skeptical of the role the U.S. plays. But I think there are also South Koreans who think the U.S. plays an important role. And so you can't – it's not as simple as just sort of walking away from the problem. You know, I do think we have a constructive role to play in providing security and making it possible for a more peaceful situation in the peninsula. So I definitely do think that we should consider policy changes. But I think walking away isn't – That won't solve the problem. It'll just leave the South Koreans and the Japanese facing the North Koreans by themselves, and I think some of the underlying problems we have are still going to be present.
Well, let me thank Luke for his call and go to a comment I'd like to get your response to, Philip Yun. Chris writes, why don't we start shooting down their test missiles so they can't get any data from their testing?
So besides, well, I think there's a myth out there that some of these larger, longer-range missiles, the ones over Japan, that we could shoot them down. In fact, they're so high that we won't be able to do so. Under very small circumstances, could we? And the only way we could do...
Certainly been a lot of advocacy of that.
Right, yeah. A lot of advocacy. And I think there's a myth out there that that's something that actually can happen. And for this one, the ones that went over Japan, for example, when they went over Japan, very too high, can't reach them. And the only way we'd be able to hit them is when they're on their way down and they've already passed Japan. So we can presumably hit them, you know, while they're standing there on their bases. And the liquid fueled ones, you'd have the ability to do that. But that's extremely provocative and could risk escalation in a way of a huge exchange. And then what we have also is the North Koreans are working on solid fuel, which is some of the stuff that they've been doing over the past few years. And so what you've noticed in these missile launches, and Jeffrey, you can correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of these missile launches have been coming from different places too. So unless you know where they are, and you have a lot of time in order to do that, it would be more difficult than to hit them while they're actually stationary.
I believe for the most part we don't know where they're coming from. And let me, we know where our callers are coming from. Here's one from Woodside. Gregory, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say I really hope the Congress is responsible for what Trump is doing. You know, I don't know why they're giving him such a long leash, but I feel like, you know, as public servants, they're responsible for making sure that, you know, the American people are well, both physically and mentally, and all of this is just causing such, you know, physical stress on the public. I don't find it acceptable, and, you know, to think that we possibly could be in danger because of this, you know, childish 70-year-old irresponsible public servant is just beyond my belief.
Gregory, I appreciate your comments, and I thank you for them. We'll let them stand, and we'll go right to another caller, and that's Damien. Morning. You're on the air on Forum.
Good morning. I have a quick question. I know you kind of went to it a little earlier, but what exactly is the issue at heart that stops a peace agreement between North Korea and South Korea?
Philip Yun?
So the way I look at it is that the United States up to this point has thought that a peace agreement of some kind without is just a piece of paper. That's been sort of the truth, and it really doesn't mean anything on the ground. And so the United States traditionally has wanted to do what they call confidence-building measures. They wanted to show, have both sides show that they're genuine and about peace, and therefore would only do that once they would, unless they had confidence that something like this would last. They also look at a peace treaty like this as a reward to North Korea, and it's something that we won't do under these kinds of circumstances. What I think is missing the point is that we have to test this whole rhetoric of North Korea as this hostile policy. That's what they've been talking about for the last 25 years that I've been involved with them, and they've always pointed to the peace treaty. So my view has been, so what, it's a piece of paper. Let's see if this is actually something that they're genuinely concerned about, and let's move forward. So that's been always my position.
And let me thank the caller and go to a comment from Stephen Jeffrey Lewis I'd like your response to. Stephen writes, is it true that the only way North Korea can be fought without completely destroying Korea would be attacks from China and Russian territories and waters? Does any aggression by Trump automatically start World War III with the complete destruction of Seoul and all of Korea?
I don't really understand what the caller is getting at in terms of Russia and China. You know, the way that I look at this conflict, you know, North Korea has both a very large number of artillery pieces set up outside of Seoul, because Seoul is very close to what's called the inter-Korean border, the demilitarized zone. But South North Korea also rather has a large number of short and medium range nuclear armed missiles. And so if the United States were to find itself in a shooting war with North Koreans, you know, my belief is North Koreans would use those nuclear armed missiles against U.S. forces throughout South Korea and Japan, and that artillery would open up on Seoul. So there would be enormous amounts of regional destruction no matter what.
We'll have to leave it there. We hope it doesn't obviously go in that direction. Keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best. Jeffrey Lewis, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
And Philip Yun, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. When we return, we're going to talk with Franklin Foer, former editor of The New Republic, now with The Atlantic, who says big tech is hurting media and individuality. We'll hear what he has to say when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.